Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. It is just about 7:34 in the morning. The show is up front. My name is Brian Edwards Teeger. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and, frequently, other infectious diseases. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I want to start in the news headlines. Rick Bright, former Trump administration official turned whistleblower over COVID-19 turned Biden appointee, has a letter to the New York Times running saying we should be very concerned about avian influenza because there is now a third confirmed case in a human. This is in a farm worker in Michigan. For the first time, the human has respiratory symptoms, not just conjunctivitis. Bright saying, this is the path we would be concerned about the virus adapting to. When people have respiratory symptoms and they are coughing and sneezing and so forth, they are capable of spreading many more virus copies to the environment of other people. How concerned are you?
Well, it was disturbing to see that case, of course. And you described it consistent with my understanding as well. The reason for the lower respiratory tract symptoms raising a red flag is one reason is what you just said. Another reason is for the virus to attach to lower respiratory cells, it uses different receptor sites, slightly different receptor sites, which means that the virus may be adapting. I think what makes me pause about getting too alarmed by this is that it's one case. And let me put that in perspective. We don't know how many people have gotten infected with this virus to date. We've identified three people, but we're not doing really robust surveillance. We're starting to get better at it, but we're doing it. It just feels like it's moving at glacial speed. So it's possible that a lot of people have been infected, but they haven't been symptomatic. It's possible a lot of people have been infected, but they were symptomatic, but never told anybody about it. It's highly improbable that anybody got very sick because we would have noted that through hospitalizations or deaths. So we don't have good epidemiology, Brian, and that's what makes it hard to really understand where we are with avian influenza at this point. So the pithy answer to your question is, how concerned am I? I'm concerned. How worried am I? Not terribly, because this virus has not shown the ability to transmit person to person with any kind of alacrity. So that's where I think we are right now. Our feet pretty firmly planted in the air.
I feel a little bit like we're seeing early days of COVID on rewind, in that all these documented cases are in farm workers working with dairy herds. There's 69 confirmed outbreaks in dairy herds now. Presumably, they are concerned either about their immigration status or the immigration status of their close contacts and have not been terribly forthcoming with public health officials, and probably, unless they are very ill, not seeking out the kind of treatment that would get their cases documented and hopefully identified. There were early COVID outbreaks in meatpacking plants, farm worker housing, following much the same pattern, where our kind of social vulnerabilities from marginalizing a big chunk of our population became a public health problem. And it just seems like we haven't addressed that or fixed it or even remembered it.
Yes, we do. Species have very short memories. You're absolutely right. Look at the World Health Organization struggling to come to some kind of conclusion about putting together a new pandemic preparedness plan, and we can't even do that. So, it, of course, it's very disconcerting. You know, the one thing that I think about, the other thing I think about with what you're describing, Brian, in terms of the analogous possible, well, the analogous situation with the unfolding of SARS-CoV-2, is that we really don't know how often this is occurring, because we don't have great surveillance around the world, and we don't use the most modern of scientific techniques to identify the spilling over of organisms from animals to humans. It's very likely that this occurs all the time, but that almost always it's not successful with that spillover to continue to spread. So it could be that what we're seeing, because we have much better science today than we had even 10 years ago, it could be that we're identifying this avian influenza, these three cases in humans, we're identifying it a lot earlier, or we're identifying it as it's playing out, but it may very well sputter out like probably the vast majority of times that occurs. So I guess it's a glass that's half filled versus half empty. And I'm somewhere right in the middle there, and I'm not sure where we are right now.
Well, I guess that's why we keep checking in every week. Let's go to some questions from our listeners. If you want to try your luck with the phone lines, the number is 1-800-958-9008. You will certainly be able to get through. We may just have some difficulty understanding you. There are technical issues with KPFA's phone system we haven't completely worked out yet, and they seem to be worst in the morning. Again, that's 1-800-958-9008 for your Corona calls. Meantime, we're going to be taking as many questions as we can through email at coronacalls@kpfa.org. The first came in last week from a person who did not sign their name at the bottom of the email and writes, I am taking Stelara for Crohn's, which impacts my immune system. I also had Valley fever in 2005, for which there are still titers in my lung. My infectious disease specialist is considering an infusion of Pemgarda. And I am considering the pros and cons of this drug. Dr. Swartzberg, as I understand it, Pemgarda has been approved by the FDA as a prophylaxis for people at very high risk for COVID, a preventative for contracting it. This person goes on to write, what is your knowledge and opinion of Pemgarda?
Sure. Well, Pemgarda, as you just stated, has been recently approved by the FDA. But it's not a new concept. It's just a tweak on an older concept. We've had what Pemgarda is a monoclonal antibody directed against portions of the spike protein from the virus. So if you've got a lot of these antibodies floating around in your blood, and you inhale the virus and it starts to invade your system, those antibodies will protect you. And we've seen previously with the monoclonal antibodies that were administered, that they worked, and they worked quite well for immunocompromised people, people who couldn't produce a lot of antibodies from a previous infection or couldn't produce a lot of antibodies because they were vaccinated, but their bodies wouldn't respond because they were immunocompromised. So we've seen it work before. Those older ones that we had, we can't use anymore because the virus changed. And when the virus changed, those monoclonal antibodies couldn't find a place to attach. What Pemgarda is a monoclonal antibody that brings it up to date in terms of the current variants of SARS-CoV-2 that are circulating. So it's something we're very familiar with, just a little tweak on it, like the vaccines are tweaked roughly every year now. So the question for the listener who wrote in is he or she a candidate for this monoclonal antibody? And it sounds like they may very well be a candidate given the immunosuppression of the drug for Crohn's. My understanding right now is that she's certainly not, or he's certainly not, profoundly immunocompromised from this drug and may not need it, because there's a lot of data that suggests that people on this drug can respond to the vaccine. But the listener is doing exactly what they should be doing, and that is talking to their doctor who knows their case best and knows a lot more about this particular drug than I do, because it's out of my field. So I think that there's a hint that immunocompromise may be an issue because of the history of valley fever. Not, it sounds like, hasn't completely resolved. That suggests the immune system may not be working as well. Solara, an immunocompromising drug, adds to that. So it may be very appropriate. Again, the listener is doing exactly what they should be doing, talking to their doctor about it.
I guess, big picture, with these monoclonal antibody infusions as prophylaxis, is there a big downside other than the fact that as the virus continues to mutate, they will lose effectiveness?
There's not a big downside to it, no. It is given intravenously. It can cause, in rare instances, a serious allergic reaction called anaphylaxis. So that's why it has to be administered in a healthcare setting. The good news is it lasts at least 3 months, maybe a little bit longer. I have a dear friend in Berkeley, and she's significantly immunocompromised, and she's, I think, has already received it. So I think that if you are severely immunocompromised, the downside is far less than the protection you receive against this virus that is, of course, still circulating.
All right. 1-800-958-9008 if you want to try your luck with our phone lines, or coronacalls@kpfa.org if you can send your question in writing. The next from the inbox comes from Claire, who does not mention what city Claire's in. She writes, since the CDC no longer depends on COVID test results to determine when you are no longer contagious, can you clarify what the criteria is and how to proceed after diagnosed?
Right. The criteria for any respiratory viral infection, whether it's SARS-CoV-2, RSV, et cetera, is that once your symptoms are improving and you've not had fever for 24 hours, the CDC says that you can come out of isolation. The CDC also says that if you're going to be around people who are at high risk of a bad outcome when you come out of isolation, you should be wearing a mask for a total of 10 days since your diagnosis began or since your symptoms began. That's the CDC's lumping COVID into other respiratory viral infections. The idea behind that is that people who are sick and coughing and sneezing really ought to stay away from other people until they're much less likely to be shedding the virus. So that's, in a nutshell, the CDC recommendations.
Go ahead.
Okay, they make sense, I think, for 330 million people in the United States in terms of public health policy. I don't think I completely agree with them for the individual. So, for example, if I had COVID or influenza, but let's just say I had COVID and I have fever with it, and on day four, my fever's gone and my symptoms are improving. On day five, I could come out of isolation, but I would not. I would do another rapid test because the rapid test correlates quite well with the amount of virus you're shedding, the degree of contagiousness you may have. So I would do the rapid test. If it's negative, I come out of isolation exactly as the CDC recommendations were. If it's positive, I'm going to stay in isolation until it becomes negative or until I'm out to day 8, 9, or 10.
And coming out of isolation, who would you mask around at that point?
I'd mask around anybody I'm going to be indoors with, frankly, because I don't really know who is immunocompromised, who's at higher risk. So I would just do that if I was going to the grocery store or some other place indoors.
I think that's super helpful, Dr. Swartzberg. Thank you. Jan wrote in to say, hi, we are a large chorus with three performances this weekend. Should we sing with masks at the rehearsals and the performances?
I've been... over the course of this pandemic, been talking to several groups, one in particular in Berkeley, on an ongoing basis about this question. It's a loaded question, of course, because putting masks on and singing, it has an effect on the choral group. It really comes down to the individuals deciding right now. Frankly, I think it's prudent and to wear a singing mask, which they have, that does have the electrostatic forces that would protect to a pretty good degree, in rehearsals and in the performance. I know some groups are doing that and some groups are not. So that's what I would suggest, because we're still seeing a lot of people coming down with COVID. And again, we don't know who's at high risk and who's at low risk. And for many of these choral groups, there are older people in that who are at higher risk.
So the risks here, we should probably recap. You're in a chorus. You're like, by definition, in a large group of people. Everybody's projecting. They're like spraying droplets and aerosols into the air in front of them. And everybody is breathing deeply so that they have good breath support under their singing. One of the first major outbreaks very early in the pandemic was among a choral group in Washington State.
That's right. It was a big outbreak in Washington State from a choral group. And it turned out to be a super spreader. And I think we should pause and talk about super spreaders, because it's something that appears random to us at this point. That is that some people can be spreading an awful lot of virus, whether or not they're symptomatic. And other people who even may be symptomatic, but may be spreading a very modest amount of virus, not enough to infect other people. We just can't predict who they are. So you could use criteria in the chorus of saying, please don't come if you have any symptoms at all. That would eliminate an awful lot of people. But we know that up to 40% of people with COVID are shedding the virus before they become symptomatic. And some of them never become symptomatic and shed the virus. So it's not 100% guarantee. So again, it depends upon the group. The group needs to decide as a group, and each individual needs to decide.
Well, I just learned from you, Dr. Swartzberg, that there is a specific subcategory of mask rated for singers. I guess they're designed to have less of a muffling effect on the human voice. Good to know. All right, let's try our chances with KPFA's phone lines for our next question. Alfonso is on the line from Navarro. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you guys for the show. I was calling. My brother just called a couple of days ago. He's in Chicago. Something going for him, so to speak. But he had COVID a couple, 3 years ago, got over it. He did lose his taste and smell for a while, and it went away. And he just said that he just can't taste and smell anymore. And he said, well, what do you do? I said, well, take a test. And he said he did test. He didn't have COVID on the test. And I was wondering, can that happen? You get reoccurrent symptoms like that or outcomes from COVID?
Brian, could you help me? Because I couldn't.
As I understood Alfonso's question, his brother from COVID 3 years ago lost his sense of taste and smell and has never got it back.
No, he got it back.
Oh, he got it back. Okay, sorry,
yeah,
Alfonso.
Yeah, now he lost his taste and smell again, but he doesn't test positive.
Again,
but he does not test positive for COVID. He said he did it.
Got it. So the question is, can you get recurrent symptoms without another infection, Dr. Swartzberg? And I guess the second question would be, could he have gotten an infection without testing positive?
Right, and the latter, of course, is possible. So that's one potential scenario. That is, lost taste and smell, came back like it almost always does, not always, but almost always does. But then it lost taste and smell again because had an asymptomatic case of COVID. So that's one possibility. I think it's good to step back from this about taste and smell. Most of our taste comes from the ability to smell. So anything that damages our olfactory sense, the sense of smell, is going to have a major impact upon taste. Any virus can cause that. I recall a very dear patient of mine years ago in Berkeley who he just loved wine. He loved the smell of it. He loved tasting it. And he developed a respiratory tract infection, just a bad cold, and lost his taste and smell from that, and it never came back. The reason for telling you that story is because any damage to the nasal mucosa can damage the olfactory system, and that damage can rarely be permanent. So it's possible that Alfonso's brother didn't have another episode of COVID, but may have had another viral respiratory tract infection. Didn't test positive for COVID, of course, because it wasn't COVID, but it was another virus. And that could have added to the damage of the olfactory system for his brother and led to a recurrence of his loss of taste and smell.
So it could have been an added insult from any number of sources, adding to whatever injury he sustained in that first round of COVID.
That's correct. And I guess there's another possibility, but I'm only hypothesizing now because I haven't seen data, is that with the damage that COVID did initially, it may have led to permanent damage, but enough that he could have improvement, but those cells died off, and so he's lost it again. But again, we'd have to talk to an ear, nose, and throat specialist about that.
You talked about this as being the product of damage to the nasal mucosa. My understanding is that the leading hypothesis of loss of smell and taste was that COVID was doing damage to the olfactory bulb, the nerves basically connecting the sensors in your nose to your brain.
That's right. When I said nasal mucosa, the olfactory bulb lies at the way back up in our nose. And when the virus attaches to the nasal mucosa, it also can get into those olfactory nerves. So you're absolutely right. So anything that can damage, any virus that damages, can invade and damage the nasal mucosa, can have an effect on the olfactory nerves.
This is a kind of serious, enduring disability that some people got after COVID, particularly in the pre-vaccine era. Is there any significant amount of research going into treatment protocols for people in the situation of Alfonso's brother?
There is. There are quite a few protocols that are being looked at. The one that has received an awful lot of attention with some fairly good success has been retraining. That is, there are actually therapists that can help you retrain your ability to smell, and that is by holding something up with a particular odor. You inhale those odorants, and you're told this is what it is, and your brain can start to relearn that, because we don't think for the vast majority of people there's all of the olfactory nerves have been destroyed. We think that they often have to relearn their pathways back to the brain, because there's one nerve that connects to another, and to another before it gets into our brain. So we have to retrain. And that appears to be pretty effective, but it takes a while.
All right. Well, hopefully that's good news for Alfonso's brother. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much for spending another Monday with us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Brian.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.